This is Creepy and Geeky, a part of the Morbidly Beautiful Podcast Network. Welcome to Creepy and Geeky. I'm your host, Robert, and on today's episode, we're talking about Ant-Man and the Wasp. Joining me today is Jason LeBlanc. Jason is the head organizer of the Boston Horror Society, a social group for horror fans in Massachusetts. Welcome to the show, Jason.
That's great to be on, Robert. It's, I'm a big Ant-Man fan, and the opportunity to talk about one of the films in the franchise and Marvel Cinematic Universe in general, Gonna be really looking forward to talking more about this.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'm likewise a big fan of Ant-Man in the movies, maybe not so much in the comic books. I'm not sure about your level of comic book knowledge in regards to the character or in comic books in general.
Well, growing up, the Marvel comics played a big role in things I read when I was younger. Actually, one of the first things that I could pick up and read on my own were reprints of old Marvel comics, because in the late 70s, early 80s, they did this thing called Marvel Tales. And what that was basically reprints of issues of Amazing Spider-Man. So it was my first introduction to that character, to a lot of his rogues, and also just Marvel Universe in general, because sometimes it'd be issues where he would run into the Fantastic Four or Daredevil.
Right.
As far as in comics, when it came to the Ant-Man Wasp universe, not really an Ant-Man title, but I did read during the 90s West Coast Avengers. And both Hank Pym and the Wasp were members of that group. So going into the Ant-Man movies, I had some knowledge of the characters, but maybe not as much as maybe like Spider-Man or Captain America. So, when I saw the first Ant-Man movie, I was going in as more as a fan of Edgar Wright, really. Because I mean, I had loved his work on Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz. So the fact that he was picked up as a director by Marvel to make Ant-Man, it was like, oh, I don't know that much about Ant-Man, but if Edgar Wright's doing it, it's got to be awesome. Then everything that ended up happening and eventually creative differences, quote unquote, where he stepped away from the project and brought in Peyton Reed. But even with the switch in directors and some writers, I still was really impressed with the Ant-Man movie that did come out. So I kind of like with those low expectations and being like, oh, well, like your rights are involved, so maybe this won't be as good. But then when I saw it and really enjoyed it, I was like, oh, this is awesome. And I can't wait to see the sequel.
No, I agree with you about Edgar Wright. It was a huge draw. I was already like, I'm already sold on the MCU from the very beginning. I likewise, as my listeners know, I'm a big comic book fan and been reading Marvel since I was a kid, and including that West Coast Avengers run as well, where Hank Pym was at that point, he was a slightly different character. He wasn't in any of the identities that he'd been using: Ant-Man, Giant Man, Goliath, or Yellow Jacket. He was just running around in a red jumpsuit the whole time, but he had all his little gadgets and vehicles and stuff inside of his pockets, and he would grow them and use them. And I always thought that was such a crazy good idea. And then it was only for that short time that he was on West Coast Avengers, and then he's never done it since then. Every once in a while they'll pop up, he'll unshrink something or shrink something, but they made him largely in after that point just shrinking and growing himself. So I always found that was like a weird little missed potential aspect of the character. But that being said, so I had a little bit of knowledge on him as well, just from that and a few other comic books here and there, and the Scott Lang character himself, I'd read a little bit of, not a ton of, so I wasn't super familiar with him when the movie came out. But one, I was sold on Edgar Wright, and then two, I was sold on Paul Rudd because I've always been a fan of Paul Rudd. So, and the movie, despite Edgar Wright not being a part of it, the first movie still feels like it has some of Edgar Wright's sensibility still in it, especially when you look at the sequence where Michael Peña's character is rattling off a story and everything like that. That feels so much like an Edgar Wright type of thing that, and I'm glad they did it in both of these first two movies.
Absolutely. Because I mean, that's one of the nice things about when I was sitting down to watch Ant-Man and the Wasp, because I hadn't seen it in a while. I saw it once theatrically, but I hadn't revisited it. So before we were getting ready to do this chat, I ended up watching both the first and the second movies fairly close together on Disney Plus. It was interesting to see certain things from the first movie happening, and then when watching the sequel, noticing there were callbacks to the first movie. In some cases, them doing little twists on things that happened in the first film, or expanding on ideas that were only hinted at in the first film. So I got a much bigger appreciation for the sequel getting around to watching it a second time.
Yeah, I think they work really well in tandem with each other, especially because both of them kind of sit kind of outside of a lot of what's going on in the Marvel Universe, the MCU storyline. You know, obviously, between the first movie and the second movie, Ant-Man had went and helped Captain America's crew fight against Iron Man and them. But, you know, so it's good to kind of get that little bit of extra story bit. And that's what's always made the comic books great as well, is this interconnectedness where you make these references, and they do it all the time. They make references to some kind of adventure that they have had in the past in another comic book. And they used to do it. They don't do it as much these days, but they used to do it where they would put little editor's notes at the bottom of a panel. If it was mentioned, they'd put a star next to the mention. And then at the bottom, they'd put a little editor's note and go, this was in Amazing Spider-Man, whatever, you know? So I like that they used to do that. I wish they'd do it a little bit more often now, but that's what's fun about the movies, is that you can watch them. I feel like, and I've mentioned this several times before on the show, that you can watch them separately. You don't have to watch any of these movies with having seen everything beforehand. If you watch it and they do a reference to something, sure, you may not understand the reference, but you can always go back later and fill in that gap. The story that this movie specifically is telling is just enough of a story that you can understand everything going into it.
Yeah. And even they make an effort to make references to what happened in the movies you might not have seen. And they do it in a way that doesn't feel like an exposition dump. Specifically, what I'm thinking of is the scene early in the film with Randall Park, where he's his character Jimmy Woo is explaining to Cassie, like, you know, why is my dad still under house arrest? And he's going like, well, you know, in school how there's rules, you can't write on the walls. Well, your dad and Captain America, they wrote on the walls in Germany, and you know, now he's under house arrest.
I love that. Randall Park is a great addition to his agent Wu is such a great addition to the storyline. And then he gets more of his storyline later on. He's a character in WandaVision. Mm-hmm. And it's even funnier too, because of the character's continuation in that one. When he gives his card to somebody, he does it with the little magical flourish that he's learned since Ant-Man and the Wasp. So I just love those little bits that they do, where they take just this little bit from a character and play it off in another thing later on down the road. Mm-hmm. That's just something I love about the MCU in general.
Yeah, they do make an effort to make sure that everything ties in some way. Yeah. Like there is somebody,
even if it's little subtle things. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It doesn't have to be anything major, but yeah, something like that you're mentioning. Yeah. It's perfect because it kind of carries over and you see the character evolved a little bit from last time you saw him to now.
That's what makes it fun, and that's what kind of with this movie, this, like you said, this movie continues the threads that were in the first movie. We learned about how The original Ant-Man, Hank Pym, lost his wife, Janet, in the original Wasp. And this movie starts with that, with like a backstory, like with a little bit of backstory about how they left to go on this trip. And we get to see de-aged versions of both Michael Douglas and Michelle Pfeiffer. And which is great. Like, I think that, you know, sometimes it's really good that, you know, we used to have to rely on actors that may kind of look like the people when you want to do an earlier story. And I think that's still valid, don't get me wrong, but mm-hmm. I think it's nice when you can DH somebody a little bit like this and make the continuity even better. I don't want them to rely on it so much, like with Star Wars, how Star Wars has done that with Luke in the Mandalorian series and such. I think, yeah, at this point they need to find somebody, because it'd be great to have an actor who looks kind of enough like Luke to continue on mm-hmm. with that particular storyline. But when it's a one-off type situation like this, I think it's great. So
absolutely. I guess it all depends on like the situation, because there are some cases where you can have an actor come in and try to inhabit a role from another actor, and maybe it's not the exact same actor, but they have enough of a resemblance, and maybe their performance is close enough of a match that it doesn't throw you off too much. I think not a Marvel movie, but I was thinking off the top of my head. You've seen Dr. Sleep, I'm assuming.
I have, yeah.
So the part where they're kind of doing the callback, the Overlook, and obviously they weren't able to get Jack Nicholson for that sequence, but they were I'm trying to remember what actor was it? He's a regular in Mike Flanagan's troupe.
It was Henry Thomas, right?
Yes, they got Henry Thomas to play Jack Torrance. So in those cases, that works perfectly, because you had an actor kind of filling in. But what Marvel is able to do is, like, with their de-aging technology, they've gotten it to a point where it's I remember watching like the first Ant-Man, and when Michael Douglas comes out and he's young, it's like, did they get footage from like Wall Street or something? Like, how did they, how did they pull this off? He looks like mid-80s Michael Douglas.
Yeah. He looked totally like he'd stepped out of this, you know, the studio from Wall Street and just walked over to do this scene. Like, he knew he was going to have to do this 30 years later. Mm-hmm.
The technology there to de-age Michael Douglas and Michelle Pfeiffer, even if it's just for a couple of minutes, it's not too distracting, because eventually you jump back into the present day and it's not overwhelming the entire movie. It's just a brief part of it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So I when talking about this movie's I tend to like this one a little bit more than the first one, as much as I really enjoy the first one. I think the first one suffers from just a not so compelling villain. Mm. Darren Cross he's a good villain. He's not terrible, but and don't get me wrong, I like the evil for evil's sake characters as well. I love the character of Kang, and I love that they're bringing him into the MCU. And I love the High Evolutionary, who we finally got in Guardians of the Galaxy. And they're just evil to be evil. There's no, you know, they don't have the Killmonger motivation, where, you know, they've got a good reasoning for why they're doing it, but they're doing it in a bad way. And I think that's, you know, in this new movie, the Ghost fills that bill. She's got the, you know, her motivations are good, but her methods are bad. But we also have the 1-2 punch. We got her, and then we got the bad guy of Sonny Birch as well, played by Walton Goggins, he's always excellent. He's just bad for bad's sake. So we get both in this one, which is really good.
You get a little bit from column A and you get from column B. I mean,
exactly.
It's those two different types of villains that you can have. You have the sympathetic one who's with Ghost. I almost feel like she's more of an antagonist than an outright villain.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
If she was not in the situation that she was in, she would not be doing the actions that she is. And Birch is just, you know, Walton Goggins having the opportunity to ham it up and play a bad guy with flair.
I love when he gets to chew scenery like this. It's so fun.
Yeah, exactly. And he's the type that, I mean, if they wanted to, they could probably have him play a very sinister character. But they had him, I mean, like the first thing I ever saw Walton Goggins in was The Shield. And over the years, I mean, he's jumped around to all sorts of movies and TV projects where sometimes he's very comedic and sometimes he's very dramatic and sometimes he's sinister and sometimes he's silly. I like the fact that they made him like a threat,
kind of
but
a little
I mean,
bit of everything. Yeah.
Yeah. But they got to play with some of his strengths in different categories with this role. And I'm just hoping that this is not the only time we see him in the Marvel universe.
Right. Yeah.
I'd like for him to, I know he's not a big villain. I know he's not the leader. Yeah. He's not the Red Skull. He's not like one of these iconic villains that have been away a long time. And then they finally come back years later.
Right.
I don't know how many people are clamoring for Sonny Birch to return.
Right.
But as a Walton Goggins fan, I do want to see the return of Sonny Birch.
No, and that's the thing. Like, I like that, you know, he didn't die. Like, you know, so many superhero movies and Marvel's tried to get away from that by not killing the villains all the time. But I do like that, you know, because rather than kill them, just incarcerate them. That way they can come back again later or let them escape or whatever. And, you know, I like that. And even if he comes back in a very minor, small place, it would just be fun just to see him pop up again, just being a thorn in the side of somebody in that way. Just being the sleazy businessman that he is, that, you know, that's all he's trying to do. So
maybe somewhere in the future, he teams up with Justin Hammer. I don't know.
Right. That's why I was literally thinking that, too. I was like, you know, Walton Goggins and Sam Rockwell would be like this crazy, weird team together. And I think it could work. Their energies would be in sync, I think.
Well, at some point, the MCU is supposed to give us an Armor Wars movie, so who knows?
Yeah, we'll see how that works. Especially after the revelations of Secret Invasion, we'll see what where that goes.
Very true.
So no spoilers on that one yet. But it's a. This one's fun because it does have the two villains, or well, technically three. It's got three major like antagonists, not really villains, but three major antagonists. You got Ghosts, you got Sonny Birch, and you got Agent Wu. You've got all of this trying to stymie their progress forward, because what ends up happening is that Scott starts getting images of from Janet, like memories of hers, because their brains, the brain waves have become quantum entangled through his brief moment in the quantum, what is it called?
Realm.
The quantum realm. Thank you. I was like, quantum universe? No, that wasn't right. The quantum realm. And so so now they've got to, you know, he goes to talk to Hank and Janet, even though he's on house arrest. He calls them and he's supposed to have no contact with them. And he calls them and she ends up knocking him out and kidnapping him. They've been on the run. So, and I love how they incorporate the shrinking tech in this. This is exactly what I was talking about earlier with the comic books, is that they're doing in the movies what I wish they'd been doing in the comic books a lot, was using the shrinking tech to shrink the cars and shrink the building and just do all kinds of fun stuff with that. Like, especially in the end, like there's a big chase scene at the end and she throws the Pez dispenser and turns a giant. It's such a great moment. It's so silly and weird. And it's just great.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of in the first movie, the climax where it's Ant-Man versus Yellowjacket and they're fighting, and accidentally Thomas the Tank expands and like busts through the house. So the fact that that was probably one of the most talked about moments in the first movie, they leaned heavily into that in this film, and both the restaurant sequence. And the chase sequence that you mentioned, they lean very much into those abilities that Ant-Man has, where things can be expanded or shrunk rapidly, right, and being used as a way of fighting against the villains.
Yeah.
In the car chase, like the part where when Hope is able to like shrink and grow the car with that lever. And at one point she's underneath like one of the villain's cars, she shrinks down, then she hits the lever, expands and causes the other vehicle that was chasing them to like get launched and fly
right
off the road. So it's definitely something that they felt that they could improve upon in the sequel, and they really did.
No, they did great with that. You had mentioned the restaurant scene too, and you know how she enlarges the salt dispenser and everything, the salt shaker. That was great. I really enjoy that part of it. I love the little Hot Wheels box of cars that he has, that with all the different cars, and we see it later when Scott tells what's his name? Michael Pena's character. I can't think of his name.
Oh, Luis.
Luis. He tells him to, you know, just look in there to grab a new car, and he finds the little race car one. It's just,
yeah, that Hot Wheels container was like the closest thing I can think of in the movie that's the equivalent of the way I remember Hank Pym in the comics, where he had like all the little pockets,
the pouches on his jumpsuit. Yeah.
Yeah. So instead, it's a Hot Wheels container, but I mean, it serves the same purpose.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. No, I really like I said, I really like that aspect of, you know, it's great to see, you know, Ant-Man, of course, you know, doing the shrinking and the growing again in this. And then, you know, another character we haven't talked about yet is, Lawrence Fishburne's, Bill Foster, you know, is in the comic books, Bill Foster was a character called Black Goliath, who had the ability to grow like Hank Pym did. And I, you know, think they work together. I think the history in the movie is somewhat similar to what they do in the comic books. Of course, it's, you know, condensed and changed a little bit for the movies. But yeah, so they had that aspect as well, and he was a hero for a while, until his death in Civil War. In the comic books, he died, unfortunately, but it was great to see kind of mention of that character and how he had been you know, part of the team to do that, and how he had actually grown to a certain height, I guess, what, 19 feet or something like that.
Not too tall. And then I think Scott brags that it's like
65. Yeah, they're comparing sizes was what Hope stop comparing sizes. But yeah, no, it's like, I know I'm jumping all over the place, and I do this all the time.
No, that's fine.
But this is a, you know, so it feels like there's a lot of characters. It feels like there's almost too many characters. Luis and the crew kind of take a back seat in this one. Luis is more prominent than the other two. But they all kind of take more of a back seat, because Hope gets even more play, because now she's the Wasp in this, and she's got her own suit and is flying around. There's a new Ant-Man suit that Scott's using, and it's regular, or something on it's broken, so he keeps randomly shrinking and growing. And there's this great sequence in the school when he's trying to go get the original Ant-Man suit from his daughter's classroom, and so he ends up shrinking just low enough to make him look like he's one of the students there.
That went in a direction I was not expecting in the movie when I first saw it, when he's shrinking down to like toddler size. And it's a very subtle touch, but on the soundtrack, it's like they switch out the orchestra for what sounds like a Casio.
Yeah.
It's a good thing. Yeah,
the music gets all tinny and like childlike compared to the normal orchestral work, like you said. It's the whole scene is just gold. I love it. You know, I'm a I'm a big comedy fan, so anytime you add comedy to anything, it's just a huge plus for me. And it's great. That's one of the best things. If you're going to have Paul Rudd in your movie, you need to have some comedy bits. You need to give him the best lines and give him situations where he's going to be able to, you know, have fun playing to his strengths.
Mm. And this is yet again another Ant-Man script that he had a part in writing.
Yeah. Yeah. Credit, yeah. He's had help with both of them up to this point. I don't know if he had much help in Quantumania, but I'm sure he did. I'm sure he had input in it as well.
Yeah, because I was kind of curious about that. He's I don't believe he is listed in the credits for Quantumanium, but for both Ant-Man and for Ant-Man and Wasp, he's listed as a writer. He also has a writing credit on Role Models too. So
that's one of my favorites of his. So that makes a lot of sense.
Does from time to time, besides being on screen, he does also write as well, and right. adds his own sense of humor to the script.
Right. Yeah. No, I love that he gets to play around with that, gets to play around with his characters, probably has a lot of input. And that's the thing too. He may be getting writing credit, not because he's like sitting down and tinkering with the script, but maybe because he's getting a lot of say in his character specifically. And since his character is more in than anything else, that it's a significant amount that ends up getting writer credit in that. I'm not sure exactly how that works out. That's kind of what I've heard with other times where actors have gotten writing credit. It's just through like major input into their character and stuff. But either way, I think it's great. You know, it's good to see him, you know, being able to take control of his characters in that way that he gets to, have that kind of say.
Yeah, he strikes me more, whatever he's contributed to these films, it would probably be like the family dynamic, I would think, specifically Scott's. I mean, I'm only making a hypothesis, but I'm right. not him being the type that's going to be like giving a lot of notes about like Ghost's power set. But the relationship between Scott and Cassie, or Scott and Hope, or Scott and Hank, I could imagine him having a lot of input into like, oh, well, this is how I kind of like see Scott interacting with these characters. So it's not going to fall into the typical cliches that, that might happen in a lot of like comic book movies.
Right. And that's another aspect that I like about these movies is that you've got that dynamic between Scott and his daughter. Cassie, that, you know, they have this really great relationship that even though, you know, even in the first movie, you know, despite everything going on, she still loves him. He still loves her. He's doing everything to, you know, help and protect her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but he still has this sense of, the right and wrong enough to do what he needs to do. Even if that means potentially jeopardizing his house arrest or whatever, you know, he's going to do everything he can to not get in trouble, of course, but, you know, and that's, you know, that drives a lot of the narrative is him trying to do this stuff, but also not get caught by Agent Wu the whole time.
He's trying to set a good example for his daughter. Yeah. At the same time, he's like involved in these big comic book plots that involve shrinking technology and characters that can walk through walls. The moments between Scott and his daughter are really sweet. Like even at the beginning when he first pops up on screen and the two of them are playing in that cardboard maze.
Right.
And it's so like adorable that like, okay, I'm under house arrest. I can't really do too much, but I'm going to make sure I put as much effort and love as I can into these things that I can do with my daughter. So that way it's not like we're just sitting around like watching TV.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's the really good thing about it is that, you know, I couldn't say that I'd be, you know, better at that, you know, than that. I would probably end up just being like, let's just watch movies. It's okay. We're just going to watch movies all weekend. It's going to be fun. I try to be, a fun dad and do some fun stuff, whatever we could do. But you know, thankfully, my kids are adults now, so I've already passed that test. It's good to see a good dad and a good and a good relationship like that, especially in the MCU, where a lot of times you see a lot of these heroes don't have that kind of family dynamic. And so it's good to see, you know, at least a little bit of representation of that in the MCU itself. So that, you know, and that's what makes the MCU and Marvel comic books themselves so relatable for people. That's why these movies succeed so well, is because of those relatability aspects. You know, mm-hmm. you look at a lot of other superhero movies, they kind of push that stuff to the side and they don't humanize their characters. They don't bring them down to that level. And, you know, because they're just like, oh, well, we're just going to tell the adventure story. We don't care about anything else. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and it's easy to do that, you know, but that's what I think is great about what the MCU does and makes sure to balance those aspects as much as possible to keep, you know, these characters who, you know, have these, you know, crazy powers and these, you know, adventures and everything that they do, that, you know, in between all that, they make sure that people are, you know, human and relatable, and it just makes it so much more fun and interesting.
I guess that, like, even going back to something I mentioned earlier, I mean, when I was reading those early Spider-Man comics, what I always thought was fascinating about the character, well, besides, I mean, obviously the cool powers and the cool villains and all that stuff,
right.
is that at the end of the day, once the bad guy gets caught, I mean, Peter Parker still has to worry about bills and he still has to worry about, you know, taking care of family members or just, you know, trying to get a date. And it's like, oh, well, this isn't some rich billionaire, you know, that's just in his spare time, he fights crime. He's like, this is somebody that actually has, you know, other people in his life that he cares about, and has struggles and he has weaknesses, and he's a relatable character. And as much as people will criticize like the Marvel movies sometimes for being like these big blockbuster spectacles,
right,
they do put an effort to try and make these characters have flaws and have elements of them that you can latch onto and say that I've seen that, maybe not in this scenario, but situation between these family members or these friends or these coworkers that I can recognize.
Right. Yeah. No, and that's the part that I like about it, is just that, you know, because even you look at other comic books, you know, from Marvel and stuff, you know, the Avengers was always, you know, like the team books were always, all right, well, we're going to combine together and we're going to stop this big bad person. But then some of the members, like Captain America and Thor and Iron Man, they had their own titles, and then you'd go read those and they'd have their own little adventures, but you'd also get more into their personal lives and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's what was great about those comic books, was just that it was so much. And that's what it is kind of with the movies as well, is that the each individual movie of the character, you get a little bit more deeper into their personal lives. And then you get the big adventure ones in the Avengers title and the Avengers movies, where you get little pieces of their lives, but not as much as you would in their individual movies. And that's what's so much fun about these, and especially these Ant-Man ones, which are both funny and adventurous, a family drama, because not only is it with Cassie and Scott, but you also have this other family drama with Hank and Janet and Hope. So, mm-hmm. and now in this one, they're trying to get down to the quantum realm to save Janet, because now they figure she sent a message up that this is where she's at and she needs to be brought back up.
They and I've noticed in each of these movies, they have made an effort to, like, in the first movie, just there's a little bit of the quantum realm. And mm-hmm. in the second one, this, like, the third act, you finally get to spend a good chunk of time in the quantum realm. And finally, when you get to the third one, nothing but quantum realm.
Right.
Maybe quantum realm.
Yeah, no, and that's what I like. They built it up. You know, you get the little taste of it in the first one. The second one, you get a little bit more, but not too much. You don't stay too long. You get to see a little bit more fascinating aspects of it. And then, yeah, you get a lot of it in the last one, which, you know, to me was fine. I feel like the Quantum Mania was no more crazy than any of the Guardians of the Galaxy movies mm-hmm. in terms of scope and weirdness. it's just another alien landscape like those are. So, yeah, it was great to get down there and see a little bit more, kind of slow it down a bit, you know, because mm-hmm. in the first movie, he's just kind of tumbling through it and we're not getting a whole lot of time to sit and look around. And then in this one, you know, you're getting a little bit more time. You can take a breather. He takes a moment. He's stuck at one point and, you know, has to hope that it reconnects to the signal. And, you know, so you get a little chance to, you know, see the sights a little bit more in this one. So it was very interesting.
You get to see the giant, I don't know how to even describe them. Like they almost look like sea pigs.
Right. I think they're actually modeled off of like the actual mites that live on our skin. And so it's like, yeah. So it's interesting. So it's kind of what it looked like to me whenever I was watching it this time. I was like, well, that's a little disturbingly close to to that. So,
but even though you've got this elaborate sci-fi scenario, it's all coming from a place of like this family trying to
meet
another family member and bring them back, hopefully somebody that they thought they had lost a long time ago.
Right. And you know, we briefly touched on it, but, you know, Michelle Pfeiffer playing Janet Van Dyne is like, you know, such good casting. I love Michelle Pfeiffer. She's been in a ton of stuff. She's a great actress. And, you know, it was nice to see her pop up in the MCU now,
mm-hmm.
even if it was just a minor role in this first one.
Yeah, she definitely has more screen time in Quantumanium. In this movie, I mean, she does a little bit of voiceover work, and like you see her de-aged in the beginning of the film, and there's like a good like over an hour of the film where you don't really see her, unless we count the part where you know,
Scott's playing as her. Yeah,
Scott is playing Janet. Yeah.
Which is a great sequence. He does really well at that. So, you know, it's fantastic.
It is. I was worried. Like I said, it's been a while since I've seen this, and I was like, I remember that sequence. How does that play out again? But it wasn't as it didn't feel as cringy as I originally thought it
right.
was. So he does a good job trying to play Janet, and not make it too awkward.
Right.
We don't really get too much Michelle Pfeiffer in this movie, but what we do get is it's good. It's nice to see her as part of this larger cinematic universe.
Right. Yeah, and we get a lot more of her in the next one. So that's what's really good. So I'm glad that they brought her in enough to just go, okay, well, you're gonna get a little bit this time, you're gonna get a lot more next time. It'll be a major character in the next one. I think that's what's funny too, is like a lot of people complained about the next one because it's called Ant-Man and the Wasp: Quantumania, and so they're all like, well, the Wasp is barely in this one because Hope Van Dyne doesn't get much play in that one. And I was like, yeah, but maybe they were meaning the original Wasp.
That's true.
So it's gotta think. So yeah, and I like her performance. She's really good in this.
Yeah, she's I'm trying to think back of like the first thing I ever probably saw Michelle Pfeiffer in. It might have been Batman Returns.
That I probably saw her in something before that, maybe even Grease 2 before that. I may have seen her in something else. I'm not positive. Batman Returns is really the first place I remember. Like I know as like a kid that I, you know, that I really paid attention to who she was as an actress. I say kid, but that movie came out when I was 18. So, I mean, she's been fantastic. She's such a good actress. You know, Batman Returns and everything she's done since then. I'm blanking on everything she's done. But you know, it was a great addition. I was glad to see that because I was a little iffy on Michael Douglas when he got cast in the first one, but he turned out to be a good Hank Pym, which I appreciate. And you know, as much as he doesn't get a lot of runtime in this one, I think he takes more of a backseat. He's in it, but he takes more of a backseat to everything else going on mostly just because there's a lot going on. And I think they were really beefing up Hope as the Wasp in this. So she got a lot more play.
So. Well, you even mentioned it earlier that this is a film that's filled with like so many characters.
Yeah,
that you
so many
almost
characters.
Have to kind of, the filmmakers have to decide, okay, well, which characters are going to get the most screen time? Obviously, it's going to be Ant-Man because his name is in the title of the movie. And we've teased the Wasp at the end of the first Ant-Man movie, so we finally have to pay that off. So there are some other characters, like you're saying, Hank Pym gets a little bit less screen time. Luis and, well, I wouldn't say Luis, but more like the other cons that work with him, they're right, not giving quite as much screen time as before. But it's only because you've got two heroes, you've got two villains, you've got a very large supporting cast, all have to have their own little moments. So it's a tricky balancing act.
It's a lot to juggle. Yeah. And even Scott's ex-wife and her husband, who had a lot more play in the first movie, they've got a lot less in this one. They just pop up for a little extra, comedy, comic relief anytime Agent Wu comes around or whatever. And so I don't mind that so much. It's a fun movie, despite, feeling at times overstuffed. But it never feels like overstuffed in a bad way. They do that really good job of balancing all the stories, all the characters, and everything. And so that's what I think is important. They do a really good job with it. And I really think this one is a stronger movie in some ways, not always, but in some ways than the first. I think there's a few moments in the first movie that are stronger, but overall, I think it's got better villains, and a better overall story to it.
It's one that now that I've rewatched it, I'm holding more respect for what they pulled off in it.
Right.
You have to have the storyline that involves Scott and his family, and you've got Hank, Hope, and Janet and their story, and then you have Ghost, and you have Sonny Birch, and you have all the other supporting characters. So it's a lot to kind of like keep track of everything. They do a good job, I think, of balancing everything out in the end. I think what I enjoy about like at least the first movie is that initial arc of Scott becoming a hero finally, and becoming a hero in the eyes of his daughter. I think that's if there's anything that the first one clearly has over any of the sequels, it's that emotional arc that kind of propels that first film.
Exactly.
So that's when I'm thinking about that, that's definitely a stronger aspect of the first one. But yeah, the second one, I mean, it's got a lot going for it. It has a really great cast, wonderful action sequences, like we already mentioned. And it's interesting where it's placed in the MCU because it is...
right smack in between Infinity War and Endgame.
Yeah, and when it came out, people were kind of puzzled. It's like, well, how does this play out? Because we saw what happened at the end of Infinity War. What's going on in that?
Does it fit in the timeline? Yeah,
exactly.
And we find out at the end of the movie, just how close it does fit to the timeline. Because once Janet's found, I guess it's got to be like a couple of weeks later or something. They may have said on the screen, but it's got to be a little bit later, time for her to adjust being back in the real world and everything. And they're sending Scott back into the quantum realm to get some quantum energy to do with whatever. And so they send him in there, and he's only supposed to be in there for a couple of minutes, and then he's supposed to be brought back out. And you pan over after he goes in, and he's like, "Hey guys, bring me back." And you pan over, and nothing but dust. So it's our first post Infinity War blip moment, as we find out later on that it's called the blip. But yeah, it's uh, It was crazy. It was a great moment. I remember I've watched every single MCU movie in the theaters. It was a great moment for the crowd, for sure. Everybody's like, oh no. So it was like, what's going to happen with Scott? How long is he going to be in there for? It's such a great moment that plays into the beginning of Endgame. So, you know, that's what's crazy about it is that how much Ant-Man and the Wasp ends up being integral to the overall MCU storyline, at least for this phase. So,
because eventually when things do get resolved with Scott managing to get out of the quantum realm, he was very integral in how things play out in Endgame. So,
right, exactly.
You find out that even though he's been having all these adventures that are not really that tied into the grander scheme of the MCU, he's very integral to how things resolve once we get to Endgame. And I was just, you were commenting on like why they were going into the quantum realm. In the rewatch, they're saying that they're going to extract energy from the quantum realm to try and help Ghost.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And now that that we know, we've got another movie coming out in the near future that features Ghost.
Yep, the Thunderbolts. Yeah.
Thunderbolts. I'm kind of curious if there's what happened with that character between films.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if now she has that control. And everything that she didn't have before, so that she's, you know, at least solid when she wants to be and isn't in pain anymore. So, I mean, which presumably after, you know, Janet, you know, helped to heal her a bit at the end of this movie, that hopefully that between that and whatever quantum energy that they could pull from the quantum realm, that you know, hopefully that helps her. But we'll see. It's good. I think that's going to be a fun movie. It's got such a great cast of characters from all of the previous MCU stuff that it's going to be fascinating for sure.
And what I'm interested in most is I know they've already announced a good chunk of the cast of who's in it, but I almost guarantee there's got to be some people that they've kind of kept under wraps because I mean, I'm almost certain like Lawrence Fishburne has to be popping up in this movie in some capacity.
Maybe, you know, it depends on how his involvement is still with Ghost. You know, if it's, you know, it really kind of just depends on how much they want to pay him and if he's willing to accept, you know, really.
That is true. That is true.
And if they even want to tie in that story, I mean, because they may just make a slight reference to something like that without having to, like, you know, go too much into it. So, you know, and it may be just a quick, even if he does, and they do put him in it and everything like that, it probably would likely be just a quick, you know, quick aside thing, you know, maybe Val's coming to recruit her or something. And then, that's the only scene we get with him. So, which would make sense.
I was just kind of curious to see like if we'll see his character again, if we're,
yeah, it would be great.
If we're ever going to see him become Goliath on screen.
Yeah, that would be cool. Like, I like Lawrence Fishburne, so it'd be really cool to see him on screen again in the MCU, especially as Goliath. That would be really cool. Yeah. But yeah, I'm trying to think if there's anything that I missed that I wanted to talk about. I just have a lot of fun with this movie. I think I'm like you, where it definitely took another viewing to really kind of appreciate this one more so than, because the first one does have a lot going for it. I think the only thing that lets me down in the first one is the villain. You know, otherwise I think it's a very strong movie. But these two together work so well that it's just, they complement each other well. And this one definitely becomes stronger on, I think, repeat viewings. Cause I think in the beginning, you kind of compare it a little too much to the first one in a lot of ways. And then once you watch this one kind of outside of that, or given it a couple of more watches, I think that it definitely, grows on you for sure. Cause it's a good movie. It's a really good movie.
Unintended.
Yeah. pun actually unintended. So that was actually funny. Good catch though.
So. Yes. I think with the first one, when you were mentioning about villains, yeah, I mean, the Yellow Jacket is basically like Ant-Man. He can grow.
He's the shrink. Dark mirror. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's what a criticism of a lot of MCU movies is. It's like sometimes like the villain facing the hero is just basically a dark mirror version of that. Right. The advantage of this is like Ghost is such a different character and a power set so different that it makes it a little bit more interesting. It's like I said previously, I mean, rewatching this, I it's grown on me a lot more. It is, I think if I had to compare, like if I had to rank them, it might be this, then the first Ant-Man, and then Quantumanium.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've got Quantumania scored higher right now, only because, like, if I'm talking about my Letterboxd scores on stuff, is that I think I have it higher just because I like the one. I like just how big they went with it. And I know a lot of people didn't like that, that they kind of went outside of the norm that we've had with that. But going into the quantum realm, you were going to have to get big, pun intended. But I also, Kang is one of my favorite villains from the MCU or from the comic books. I love Kang as a character. And so seeing him and the alternate versions and everything, getting a chance to come out and shine, was a really big thing for me. So that helped me get over whatever minor quibbles I might've had with the movie itself, but which I had very few, honestly. The movie doesn't bother me as much as it does a lot of other people, apparently. But I really enjoyed Quantumania. And so, and like I said, with having Kang as a major villain in it, and the expansion of Janet's story, and I'll get into this in another episode, but those really, made me give it a lot more in terms of stuff. But it's kind of hard to place all three of these because they are all kind of different. They all have their pluses and minuses. So it's kind of really hard for me to grade them like that. But I think I would give the edge just slightly to number two because I feel like they found their footing and they were able to tell a more fun and more cohesive story than in the first one, where the first one was great, had great moments. The hero's journey that Scott goes on is really fun. I would say I'd give this one the edge over number one just slightly. All right. Do you have anything else to talk about that we haven't already mentioned?
I think we've pretty much covered everything. The only thing that I will tag on just at the end is simply, I was very impressed by the Ghost effects.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, that was really good.
That was visualized on screen, where you're seeing Ghost in a certain spot on screen and then a little back further.
Like a future or past version of her, just slightly out of sync with normal time. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, it's such a unique visual that the way they were able to pull that off. And then there's those creepy moments where she phases and she's like, puts her hand. I think at one point it's like when she first emerges and we realize what a threat she is when she like puts her hand through Hank's throat.
Through Hank's neck. Yeah.
Yeah. Like that. And it's like, if I decide to change what I'm doing right now, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and that's what makes the character fun and interesting, because especially because it's a little different from the character that was in the comic books too. The character in the comic books was a male, and he was a villain, an Iron Man villain. It was like a corporate espionage type of character. So it was interesting to see them kind of, change it just a little bit to make it a little bit different, which was cool.
Yeah, when it comes to Ant-Man, like I said, I mean, my exposure to the character was mostly through West Coast Avengers. But looking through his gallery, I mean, when you think about it, there's not too many of his own villains in these movies.
No.
Like, he's fighting a villain in the second movie that's more of an Iron Man villain, and he's fighting a villain that's more of a Fantastic Four and Avengers villain in the third film.
Yeah. And then Darren Cross in the original movie was it's it's a different character. It's a different character in the comic books. He's something else happens to him. I can't remember, but he doesn't become Yellow Jacket. Yellow Jacket is actually one of the identities that Hank Pym uses at one point. That's what I like about the MCU is that they take things and they kind of twist it a little bit and make it their own, and it makes it fun
for sure.
Although doing research for this, I did realize there is actually one other villain that's in this film.
Oh, yeah.
So Ghost's father, who dies in the comics, is Egghead.
Oh, interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah. Well, that, yes. That they never refer to him as that, but
right. Yeah. They just use his real name. Yeah. Oh, that makes things interesting. Yeah. I didn't catch that. That's really cool. Egghead Egghead in the comic books is an interesting character because Hank actually murders him at one point in the comic books. Yeah, it's when he is Yellow Jacket. And at that point, Hank had become mentally unstable. So he ends up murdering Egghead at one point. So, yeah. So that's interesting that they added it in there as a nice little catch for the comic book fans.
They'll sometimes do that in the films. They'll just like you were saying earlier, what they were doing with Lawrence Fishburne's character, how at one point was Goliath, and even though you never see him in the costume, but they refer to it as the Goliath Project. So that they do make an effort to like look through the history of the MCU and see what they can kind of like put in there as a little Easter egg for fans to spot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I love that whenever they do anything like that, because it's very much what the comic books do. They'll leave in little references here and there to something else, and you'll have to just go find it later. And if you know the reference, then you just be like, oh, cool. That's some story I read before. So, it's really, really fun with that. That's what I really love about the MCU is they're taking what they do in the comic books and bringing it to the movies. And that's why no matter what they do, for the most part, I'm all in. So I've been a fan of pretty much everything they've done, more or less degree, depending on the project and everything. But I'm all in for as long as I can get it. So.
Same here.
Yeah. All right. Well, why don't you let people know where they can find you online?
Oh, absolutely. So as you were saying earlier, I run Boston Horror Society. We're a social group that's in Massachusetts, but we do a lot of events. If you do a Google search and just put in Boston Horror Society, you'll be able to find us on either Meetup or Facebook. As far as like my social media handle, I'm on Blue Sky and Twitter. And I go under Beantown Horrors. It's October as we're recording this. So it's our busy season.
You're right.
I can only assume I was invited as a guest because there's a character in this movie called Ghost.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's awesome. Yeah, definitely everybody go check that out. It sounds like a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you. It is.
Yeah. All right. Well, I appreciate you coming on. This has been a real fun time.
Oh, same here, Robert. It was great to be a guest on the show. And it's looking forward to hearing the rest of this series that you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll definitely have you back on in the future for sure.
Oh, glad to hear that.
Yeah. All right. Thanks again to Jason for joining me. On Monday, Amber Knapp returns to the show to complete my series on the Chucky franchise with Curse of Chucky and Cult of Chucky. And on Friday, Katrina returns to the show to talk about Captain Marvel. Thanks for listening. Creepy and Geeky is a part of the Morbidly Beautiful Podcast Network. Please check out morbidlybeautiful.com/podcasts for more great shows. If you like what you've heard, please consider giving the show 5 stars and a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Also, please share the podcast on social media to help spread the word. Make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast app or at creepyandgeeky.com. Music for the podcast is Gratitude, composed by Jerry Smith. You can follow the podcast on social media at Creepy and Geeky on both Twitter and Instagram. If you'd like to follow me, I'm GeekThulu on Twitter and Blue Sky, and Geek.Thulu on Instagram. You can support the podcast by ordering teas and more on TeePublic or by donating to the coffee page. All of the links are in the show notes. Finally, don't forget, stay creepy.